Welcome to The Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we'll talk about revisionism about free will, a class of views according to which our common-sense view about free will needs to be revised.
Our guest today is Manuel Vargas, and as always, if you have questions for us, please feel free to submit them through our website, thefreewillshow.com, or via social media, at The Free Will Show. I'm happy to introduce Manuel Vargas, who's professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. Manuel has written many articles on free will and moral responsibility, and he's the author of a book called Building Better Beings, A Theory of Moral Responsibility, which was published in 2013 by Oxford University Press. He also contributed to the Four Views on Free Will volume that John Fisher mentioned in our interview with him in season one. In that volume, Manuel defends the revisionist view of free will that we'll be talking about today. So welcome to the show, Manuel. Can you tell us and our audience a bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on free will?
Sure. Thanks for having me here. My interest in these things was, in some sense, it's a kind of paradigmatic case about how not to do philosophy. I got interested in these things entirely by accident, and it's just sort of artifacts of personal history. As an undergrad, I just really wasn't actually much interested in the problem of free will. I had a friend, Chris Koontz, who's now a philosophy professor as well, who was really interested in this question and always kept trying to convince me there was a super set of interesting questions here on about free will. And I was just like, nah, that stuff's totally boring. I have no interest in it whatsoever. And then in graduate school, I started my graduate training in a place where everybody thought incompatibilism was just obviously true. And I took a grad seminar by Peter Vanenwagen that was really kind of formative, helped me see what was going on in the literature and give me a sense about what the issues were and why they were super interesting. But then I transferred graduate programs and I went to a graduate program where everybody thought that compatibilism was obviously true. And they couldn't figure out how anybody in their right mind could be an incompatibilist. And so this kind of left me with a puzzle about how so many smart, thoughtful people could disagree about this thing. And of course, in philosophy, disagreements is sort of easy to come by. But but it wasn't just the disagreement. It was the thought that they couldn't figure out how to wrap their heads around recognizing why anyone might find the opposing view at all remotely plausible. So in one graduate program, everybody just thought compatibilists had to be crazy or they were liars or engaged in wretched subterfuge or something. Right. And in the other graduate program, they just thought that there was a kind of mental illness that seemed to have afflicted incompatibilists. And you know, like, what the heck are they on about? Like, surely they're not being ingenuous or honest about their convictions. So that was, I mean, how I ended up getting pulled into thinking about these things when, you know, only a few years before I thought, you know, there's just nothing interesting here. So yeah, don't do philosophy the way I do, as a kind of accident of sociological experience.
Yeah. Well, as the name revisionism suggests, your view is that we need to revise our thinking about free will. Can you start by giving us some examples of other concepts that we have revised our thinking about?
Sure. So think a little bit about some kind of standard cases in the sciences. So, you know, the old Empedoclean or Aristotelian conception of water as one of the four basic indivisible substances of the universe. The molecular theory of water comes about, and we come to realize that water is neither basic nor indivisible. Or, you know, simultaneity in physics, general relativity theory changed how we thought about that, or the transition from, say, the miasma model of disease to the germ theory of disease. And in all of these cases, there's a kind of everyday intuitive idea about how these things went. And then there was some kind of innovation, discovery, transformation, conceptual or empirical pressures that moved people off of earlier, to put it crudely, pre-scientific ways of thinking about those kinds of things. So those are kind of science, standard science-y cases, but I think it doesn't take a whole lot of reflection to see that in our social lives, and especially if you look at the kind of history of social concepts or socially embedded concepts, you find the same basic transformations happen. So the concept of marriage. If you go back far enough, a very kind of traditional concept of marriage was it's a kind of thing that falls out of a property exchange between two men. So I'll trade you my daughter in exchange for three chickens and a goat. And then once we've done that, then now you're the owner of my daughter. Just for the record, I'm not trading any of my daughters for any of my goats. But that case, you know, people came to think about marriage relations in very different ways, whether you go sacramental or whether you think of it as a companionship marriage. And then, of course, in our lifetimes, fights over the possibility of gay marriage. And so, the social concepts have this sort of thing as well. We've seen this, you know, with conditions for criminal conduct where, you know, back in the 12th century in English criminal law theory, there was no mens rea requirement. There's no guilty mind, requirement. And that got added, or, you know, today maybe we're seeing shifts in how people think about the nature of race or how they think about the nature of gender. So I just think conceptual change is all over the place. And once you get outside of philosophical circles and start thinking about the history of concepts and the history of social practices, you start to see revisionism is widespread, and it's a kind of common part of our conceptual or practical tool bag.
Mm-hmm. Great. And you talk about revisionism having sort of two tasks, or at least revisionism about free will has two tasks. One you call diagnostic and the other prescriptive. So let's start with the diagnostic task. What do you think is our common sense way of thinking about free will, and why do you think it's incorrect?
So my views about this have changed a bit over the years. I used to think the simple answer was common sense is libertarian, and where I mean libertarian in the oldest and truest sense of the term, that is incompatibilism about free will and thinking that we have free will. Mm-hmm. So that used to be the kind of the basic thought. And then I thought, there are various kinds of both philosophical and empirical worries about libertarianism. So that even if it turns out some form of libertarian agency was going to be sufficient for freedom or responsibility or any number of other notions kind of lurking in this area, that there was reason to be worried about whether or not we had it, and reason to be worried about practices that we have, whether legal or moral practices, that presume that we have it, given the kind of evidence that was available for whether or not we had the kinds of forms of agency that libertarianism seemed to require. So I got to be worried that common sense, what I was thinking of as common sense libertarian views, were in trouble, that we were asking them to do a lot of work for which we had very limited evidence for, and in some cases, reasons to be skeptical that we had that kind of agency in the right degree at the right times, and that we could make it kind of fit with a broadly scientific picture of the world. So that was the old view. I mean, increasingly, I guess I've come around to the view where I think that maybe the kind of conceptual issues here are more complicated. So that even though we might have some thoroughgoing natural incompatibilists and some thoroughgoing natural compatibilists, where these are just, you know, we go out and look at people out in the world and see how their conceptual commitments go, that there really are some genuine kind of common sense everyday natural compatibilists and everyday natural incompatibilists, and maybe even a significant number of natural incompatibilists. I also think that a lot of people just have a mix of nascent theoretical commitments that can and do, in fact, get regimented in different ways depending on the kind of accidents of their history or maybe their religious commitments or what kind of society they get raised in. And so I think a lot of the puzzles that we see in free will and the kind of sociological phenomenon that I was talking about at the opening of this podcast arises in part because of this fact, the idea that our pre-theorized commitments allow themselves to get regimented in different ways, and very small things can push them one way rather than another. But nevertheless, I guess I still think at the end of the day that there's a significant strand of thinking that is common to many people, not all people, that readily turns out to be regimented or understood in broadly incompatibilist ways. And that's where I think a lot of the challenges about free will get going.
Yeah. And you think that there's really no way to make sense of a libertarian free will, or libertarianism about free will. Is that right? Or has your view on that changed as well?
Well, so I don't think it's that there is no way to make sense of it. I think it's a coherent view. And okay. And I guess I've always, well, I don't know about always, but at any rate, for most of my professional career, thought that it was, it's an intellectually coherent view. It's that there are reasons to be worried about whether or not we have it. And there are reasons, in some sense, kind of practical reasons of worrying about whether or not the kind of evidence we have for it is sufficient to ground the kinds of practices that we have that appeal to it. So one way of putting it, it goes something like, you know, if we think that part of the explanation for why we put people in prison, for example, is that they were morally culpable for what they did and a virtue, and why are they morally culpable? Well, they acted freely. And then we say, okay, so what's the evidence that they acted freely? What's the evidence that in fact they have this kind of libertarian agency of the sort that is going to ground whatever that extra amount of time is that they're in prison for above and beyond what, say, deterrence would get us? There, I think that the evidence begins to look vanishingly bad, or, you know, vanishingly small amounts of evidence or not particularly compelling evidence to ground the kinds of practices that we have, if that's mm-hmm. all the story turns out to be.
Yeah,
I see.
All right. So that was the diagnostic task. Let's turn now to the prescriptive task of your account. So why do you think that we ought to think about free will differently than we ordinarily do?
Well, so I guess I think it goes something like this, as a theoretical construct. I guess I'm not sure that free will has ever had only a single conceptual role. I think there have been different kinds of things that we've used the term free will to pick out, different kinds of conceptual functions or ways of organizing our thinking and practices. But I do think one relatively common role, or one that shows up a lot in the history of thinking about these things, and that's maybe especially salient in the modern period, although I think that's a kind of disputable issue, is it has to do with responsibility attributions. So if we understand free will as a kind of thing that licenses responsibility attributions, then questions about the existence of free will, I think, in some sense, become questions about whether or not there's something that licenses responsibility attributions. Hmm. So here, I think, if you get to that thought, then normative questions end up going live. So it's just not going to be enough to claim that free will involves some kind of power. We have to say what kind of power that would license. And so I think here's where we end up with a story, I think, is I guess I'm inclined to think there is a story we can tell about why it is that we have reason to have these practices, why it is that we would want to have these practices, why it is that we'd want to keep track of whether or not agents were of one sort rather than another sort. And so when you ask, why think about free will differently than we ordinarily do, I think, well, it turns out that, I mean, the kind of short answer is it just turns out we have good reason to hold on to this concept, even if it isn't the thing that we thought we had when we first started out. It's one of those kinds of concepts that turns out to be good to keep around, even if it isn't the way we ordinarily thought. And so I think in that sense, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, the concept of a holiday. So, traditionally a notion of a holiday, you'd go back way where, you know, what's the origin of this idea? It was time we took off in order to engage in certain kinds of religious practices. So it was time we set aside for doing religious rituals. So we stopped doing work to go do religious rituals. You might imagine, a totally atheist society that just has no truck with religious practices whatsoever. You know, that this society could still have really good reasons for caring about and having and sustaining holiday practices, mm-hmm. even in the absence and collapse of the religious practices that gave rise to the having of the practice in the first place. And so I think free will is a little bit like that. I mean, it might turn out that there was a certain kind of set of works, maybe theological or maybe metaphysical work, that the concept of free will originally had and still has in some certain kinds of contexts. Mm-hmm. But at least for the purposes of thinking about and managing our keeping track of forms of agency and its relationship to certain kinds of normative social practices, there, I think, you know, it's earning its keep, even if it's not earning that keep in quite the same way that we used to think we were doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, maybe you could say a little bit more about exactly how the justification for our responsibility practices works. So in your 2013 book that I referred to earlier, Building Better Beings, you call your model the agency cultivation model. Could you say a bit about the model and how it's related to revisionism about free will?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. So here's the kind of underlying thought. So if we're going to hold on to a concept of free will, even though we think, you know, suppose you went along with me on this, the thought that it looks like it's unclear whether or not we've got evidence for thinking we've got libertarian free will, or maybe it's sufficiently metaphysically demanding that we're uncertain about whether or not the world is really built in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you go for either the kind of epistemic or metaphysical worries about free will, suppose you accept, okay, look, there's a problem here. And then you think, well, but we can't yet get rid of it until we know whether or not there's a reason to hold on to it. And so then I say, well, here's one way of thinking about what would give us reason to hold on to it is if we could show that it does some kind of work for us in the same way in which holding on to holidays could conceivably do a certain kind of, if you'll excuse the bad inverse pun, do a certain kind of work for us. And so if it turns out that having relaxation time or time to take care of your own home or whatever, it ends up being really valuable for us, that's a reason to hold on to it. Okay, so that's what we need. We need a story about that, a story that justifies retention of the concept, even in the face of impugning the kind of pre-revised concept or the diagnostic notion. Okay, so what's that story? Well, this is where the agency cultivation model comes online. It's a kind of conjecture, and the conjecture has to do or goes something like this: the thing that gives us a reason to hold on to our responsibility practices, it just is that having responsibility practices does a certain kind of thing for us. It helps us cultivate forms of agency that are valuable, that we have reason to care about, that we have reason to want to have, and it helps sustain those practices. So more particularly, the idea is once you have a certain ability to recognize and respond to reasons, your moral sensibility, the kinds of things that you weigh in your considerations are partly shaped by social feedback that you get. And that's what praising and blaming practices do, is that they shape our moral sensibility, which in turn shapes the kinds of reasons and considerations that we are paying attention to, that we alert to, that we look to cultivate in ourselves and other people. And so that's the thought. That's the agency cultivation model says that free will attributions earn their keep in light of the way in which they help us organize responsibility practices that perform a certain important function for us. That is turning us into agents that we have a reason to want to be. That is to help build us into better beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. All right. Let's move on to some objections to your view.
There aren't any, so this is going to be
yeah, of course.
It's a short episode.
yeah. Well, revisionism says that a suitably revised conception of free will is compatible with determinism. So some people might worry that this is not so different than other forms of compatibilism, especially semi-compatibilism, because you've got that reasons responsive component. And this is a variety we talked about in a last episode with Michael McKenna. How would you explain the difference between revisionism and this form of compatibilism?
Well, I guess as a first pass, I'd want to caution against a potential category mistake here. So I think of revisionism as a class of theories, and it's a class of theories that is compatible with prescriptions that go in a lot of different ways. So remember, what makes a theory revisionist is just that the prescription, that is the view about how we ought to go forward, is in conflict with aspects about how we already tend to think about things. That is the diagnostic portion. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing in that characterization of revisionism that precludes the possibility of, for example, a libertarian revisionism. So somebody could think, for example, that our default views are libertarian, but that they're agent causal, and that maybe what we really ought to go in for is a kind of event causal libertarianism. and maybe the event causal libertarianism and its kind of attendant reductionism runs afoul of anti-reductionist elements in how we tend to think about free will. So you could have a view like that where you think, no, we should just be event causal libertarians and own up to the kind of reductionism in the picture. And that's a kind of revisionism about free will. So I think what makes a theory revisionist just is that conflict between the prescription and the diagnostic element. And so I think nothing in revisionism by itself entails compatibilism. It's just I happen to be a revisionist compatibilist. And I think that's the most appealing place to go, in part because I think some of the central challenges for ordinary thinking about free will are tied into a commitment to the libertarianism. And it's a commitment to the libertarian elements that I think we can do without, or that I think of as kind of gratuitous in various ways. Not gratuitous in the sense that they don't do any work at all or couldn't do any work, but it's that we can do that, capture the work we need it to do in other sorts of ways. So that's just a kind of prefatory initial dodging of a totally sensible question you're asking about, like what's the difference of the positive prescriptive thing. But I think that's an important thing to keep track of because oftentimes people sort of run those things together. Is that relatively clear? Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful because, I mean, yeah, I've always thought of revisionism as your view, which is a compatibilist revisionism. But yeah, it's nice to have the sort of thinking of it as a class of views on the table.
Yeah, same here.
Great. Well, so maybe if it's okay, I'll take a shot at saying a little bit more, though, about how I think about my particular version of revisionism and its relationship to what I think of as kind of conventional forms of compatibilism.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So I guess I think, it helps to start with the following thought, maybe. We might disagree about, you might disagree, for example, about what form of revisionism a marriage ought to take. For example, if we're going to be marriage revisionists, we might think, look, it's time to change our concept of marriage. We've got various reasons for doing so. We're going to disagree about those particulars. But I think disagreement about the prescriptions is one place you can have disagreement. But you can have agreement about prescriptions, but still have important disagreements about the kind of underlying mechanisms and what's involved and what follows from that and how that methodologically ties into different kinds of challenges for your theory building. So one way to put it is, think about the miasma disease theorist and the germ theory disease theorist. They might both agree, like, hey, we should definitely, stay away from contaminated air. But the explanations for why we should stay away from contaminated air looks different. The miasma theorist says it's because, diseased air coming off of dying bodies, that's where you get sick from. And the disease theorist says, the germ theorist says, no, it's because there's germs in the air here. And that's what's doing the work. It's not just that it came off of a dead body or something like that. It's this pathogen in the environment that we can't see. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's in some sense how I think about the relationship between the kind of revisionism I like and the compatibilism. It's got a little bit of that kind of structure where I think, well, look, the reason why we should hold these views isn't because it's the views that you're going to find if you go out and survey the folk. And we end up coming back thinking, look, the everyday view is a compatibilist view. I think that's the conviction of most standard compatibilists, as they think philosophical theories are largely regimentations of common sense. They're not in any serious conflict with common sense. What we mean by, for example, can talk or ability talk just is whatever it is that the compatibilist analysis gives. I think that's just, I think it's not true. I'm not sold on that. So I guess I'm inclined to think that if it turns out we've got convergence, that's great. I'm really happy when we find those convergence, but I think about the theoretical roles as different. And then, of course, when you get down to brass tacks, some of the pressures about what the shape of the prescriptive theory looks like goes differently if you're not worried about holding on to elements of common sense that you think are bound up with the forms of agency you're trying to repudiate. So I think on questions about, about the history of agents and how much does it matter that agents have a particular kind of history or not for being responsible, or can you just appeal to structural features of agency? I think some of that is partly an artifact of whether you're going revisionist or not in the positive account.
Well, that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've talked about a kind of objection from, I guess, the sort of compatibilist perspective. Here's one from the sort of skeptical vantage point. Since your version of revisionism is committed to common sense being thinking of free will in this sort of incompatibilist way, why not be like the skeptic who says, yeah, that's what free will is. It's, you know, free will is this thing that's incompatible with determinism. And so we should just give up our view of ourselves as free and responsible. I know you've said a little bit about this in talking about your agency cultivation model, but what would you say to someone who's really digging in their heels and saying, no, we should just give up our views of ourselves as morally responsible?
So I think there is there are different kinds of answers that are live here for me. So one is the ambitious answer. The ambitious answer just says, look, free will's like water. It's a real thing about which we happen to have false beliefs. And so the question about, like, why shouldn't we just give up free will? I think, you know, just run the analogy on water. So at the discovery of the chemical theory of water. So the discovery of the chemical theory of water, in retrospect, it looks like it would have been astonishingly bold for a philosopher to say upon the discovery of the chemical theory of water, oh, I guess there never was any water, because it turns out water was neither basic nor indivisible. Mm-hmm. And I think in retrospect, that just looks like a kind of crazy reaction to have to some phenomenon. And I think in the context of thinking about free will, I think there's a kind of there's a sort of parallel or a potential parallel here about the, well, sure, the discovery that we aren't agents of the sort that we thought we were before might entail that we've got to change our beliefs, but it doesn't follow that we have to give up the categories unless we can show that there's not any good reason for holding on to the category any longer. So I think that's a kind of ambitious answer to think, no, there's a kind of reality to the thing of free will. We just misunderstood it, and this is a kind of correction, getting our beliefs in alignment with the way the world's built. That's what I think of as the ambitious answer.
Yeah.
But then the less ambitious answer is a little bit like the kind of holiday answer I was giving earlier, where the thought goes something like, you know, look, it's true. You know, we used to go in for group or religious practices, and now, you know, lots of us are inclined to think there is no point to those practices, or we don't need those practices. And so for people who have that thought, you know, it doesn't follow from that that therefore we should never have holidays. It's just it turned out, oh, you know, one of the things we discovered along the way is there's lots of good reasons to have holidays. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I think, you know, both of those kinds of things offer principled reasons to resist the move from no free will like we thought to therefore let's just be hard incompatibilists or skeptics about free will. So I guess for those kinds of reasons, like I'd be inclined to flip the question on its head. Why adopt skepticism? It seems to me that here, as pretty much everywhere in philosophy, denial of useful concepts has to be earned. And I think if you think about the history of these things, I think it's kind of, it's an interesting thing to think about, because what you'll see is, you know, up until, you know, relatively recently, really over the kind of past 50 years in thinking about free will, there was this kind of move that propelled skepticism about free will and moral responsibility in most of the cases where people were pushing it. And the move was one that I think we now know is kind of demonstrably a mistake. It was the move that goes something like, you know, whatever free will and moral responsibility turn out to be, if free will's got to be this thing as we imagine it to be, and if we find out that the world isn't built like we thought, then nobody's got free will. But, you know, that, like I've been emphasizing here, that argument, that form of argument just doesn't work. It doesn't work for the Aristotelian theory of water. It doesn't work for marriage. It doesn't work for race. It doesn't work for all kinds of things. And so I think eliminativism is a kind of knee-jerk reaction. It's an understandable and intelligible reaction to the discovery that things aren't like we thought they are. But then as a kind of considered philosophical position, I think it turns out it's in the same shape as everything else. It's got to earn its place, and you don't get to automatically get it just because the world isn't the way you thought it was.
Yeah. Are there any other challenges to revisionism that you would like to address right now?
So I do think one of the biggest and most interesting challenges to revisionism comes from thinking about the stakes between revisionism and eliminativism and what it is that would license us going one way rather than another. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I guess I think if it turned out that that responsibility practices didn't work in the way in which I'm conjecturing that they work, that is, that they didn't shape our sensibilities in certain kinds of ways, or that the ways in which they shaped our sensibilities were on balance worse than not having the concept at all, or worse than getting rid of the practices in some sense, mm-hmm. Then I think that would be a reason to refrain from going the revisionist route. And so I think there's a kind of possibility here. So you can imagine in kind of early feminist critiques about marriage that a lot of folks were noting, look, marriage kind of grows out of these property relations and the idea that women were owned and that ownership of women was going to be passed from one male to the next, from the father to the spouse. And so some people thought, well, given that history to the concept, we should just get rid of the concept. It just turns out there's too much perniciousness built into practices around a concept thus understood. And there's a way in which it does look like there is a kind of empirical question here. There's an empirical question about whether or not we really can rebuild the practice in a way that doesn't reinscribe or reinforce kind of notions of ownership and notions of control and notions about who gets to decide and public-private sphere kinds of distinctions and so on. So I think that, I want to take seriously the possibility that we could discover of any practice that we're inclined to go in for revisions on, that it should just turn out that it's too entwined with things that we do better to get rid of. But I guess I think in the case of responsibility practices, here I'm inclined to think, I think Strawson was right that we have these reactive attitudes that even if they're, can be kind of pushed around a little bit at the edges, they're largely relatively implastic. Mm-hmm. And certainly at population levels, it's very difficult for us to scale up to societies that don't have anything like responsibility practices. And so I think there's a way in which even if individuals can do it, it's not at all clear to me that societies can. And so I think there's a way in which I think of our reactive attitudes and our responsibility practices as a kind of collective solution to features about our psychology and features about the advantages of shared cooperative living. And so we're going to have some version of those practices. And then the question is just, how do we make those practices better and worse? How do we keep them from being as pernicious as they sometimes can be? And how do we get the good stuff out of them while kind of restraining the sometimes genuine and very real negative consequences of having blame practices? So I think for me, that's where the game is. But mm-hmm. but I also think that the decision point between being a revisionist or being an eliminativist partly turns on your assessment about whether or not there's a way to pull off, as it were, reasonably, I don't want to say kinder and gentler version of praising and blaming, but I do think there's something about can we do it in such a way that on balance it's less bad than good?
Yeah.
This has been awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Manuel. Where can listeners go to follow your work?
Well, thanks for having me. If you want to inflict more of these ideas on yourself, you can always take a look at Building Better Beings, where I try to work out these ideas in a lot more detail. But for bite-sized chunks of these things, all my publications eventually end up at vargasphilosophy.com.
Excellent. We'll link that in the show notes so people can find it very easily.
Yeah. And again, thank you. So in our next episode, we'll be talking about Mysterianism with Seth Shabo, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Delaware.